And today we're going to finish up that series by talking about how hope can be an anchor. How hope is an anchor. And so we're going to dig right into it. We're going to look at Hebrews chapter 6. If you have a Bible or you want to swipe open your app and follow along, Hebrews chapter 6 verses 13 through 20 is where we will find ourselves today. And we get a really great description of what it means to have hope as an anchor. So follow along with me, if you will, as I read this passage. When God made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and give you many descendants. And so after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised. People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where our forerunner, Jesus, has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So if I were to ask you this morning, right off the top of your head, to look at this question with me, what might your answer be? What are the most commonly recognized symbols of Christianity? What are the images? What are the visible representations that when the average person sees that thing, they go, oh yeah, that is a connection to Christianity. That's a connection to that long-held faith for thousands of years, right? All right, I've given you enough time to think. So I think probably the very first one we would most all agree on is this. Obviously, the cross is and has been a symbol of Christianity for just such a really, 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 really long time. It's a symbol and a sign that is very easily connected with Christianity. However, beyond that, anybody have any ideas what other symbols are maybe the most commonly associated with Christianity? A fish? A dove? Church bell? Manger? Wow, I am embarrassed to admit that you guys are getting all the answers that I thought you wouldn't get. I thought I would be able to like cruise through and stump you on some of this. But yes, like an example is the fish, the Jesus fish or the ichthus fish, so named because the word in Greek, it's an acrostic for Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. It was used in the early church very, very often. So it is a long-used symbol, and it is a very familiar symbol of Christianity. And somebody said a dove. That's another one. A dove being a symbol of Christianity, you know, going all the way back to the story of Noah, including the story of Jesus. The dove is another example. Somebody mentioned manger. This time of year is absolutely a time when you see any sort of manger or nativity scene, you can immediately go, ah, yes, I know what that is connected to. Also, a church steeple, I think someone said a bell, like when you drive by a building and it looks like this on top, that is a form of construction that shows you, that declares to you that that is a Christian building or a Christian facility. But you may be, maybe not, I don't know, you guys are pretty smart apparently, but you may be as surprised as I was to find out that in the first 200 or so years of Christianity, the first couple hundred years of the church, the most common symbol associated with Christianity was the anchor. Exactly, that was my thought. Huh. I would have never known or thought that the anchor was such a critical common symbol of Christianity in those first couple centuries. I did a lot of looking into that during the week. Michael Card, the Christian recording artist, had an album in 2006 called Soul Anchor, and he talked about what he learned in preparation for that album, and he said this: the first century symbol for Christianity wasn't the cross, it was the anchor. If I'm a first century Christian and I'm hiding in the catacombs and three of my best friends have just been thrown to the lions or burned at the stake or crucified and set ablaze as torches for one of Emperor Nero's garden parties, all of those things actually happened, that's not dramatization. The symbol that most encourages me in my faith is the anchor. When I see it, I'm reminded that Jesus is my anchor. And the usage of this symbol goes really, really far back. Around 100 AD, one of the early church leaders, Saint Clement, was actually banished by the Roman Emperor Trajan. He was banished away. He was doing too good of a job of proclaiming the Christian faith and gaining disciples. And so the emperor, very unhappy with that, because there was a very big clash between the two, the emperor said, "You're out of here." Sent him to Crimea, which is near modern-day Ukraine. And what did he do when he got there? Same thing he'd been doing. He converted a ton of people in that area. So eventually, the emperor said, you know what? Took him in a boat, took him out to sea, tied him to an anchor, and threw him overboard. One of those early martyrs of the Christian faith. And so when those early Christians saw this symbol, they remembered the story of St. Clement and his faithfulness. They remembered this idea from Hebrews chapter 6 that we have this hope as an anchor for our souls. And make no mistake, those earliest recipients of Hebrews, that letter, they were under intense persecution. Absolutely intense persecution, the kind described by Michael Card in that song. But before we get to how this anchor is hope for our souls, I want to get to what leads to that in that Hebrews passage that we just yet read, because it says, you know, we have this hope, but to understand this hope, we need to understand everything that came before it. And what came before it is this very, very brief recap of the relationship between God and Abraham, which lays the ground for the hope that is talked about as an anchor. So let's revisit that just briefly so we get an idea of what we're talking about when we talk about it being a source of hope and an anchor for our souls. First, there's God's promise. We go back to Genesis chapter 12 for that. God's promise to Abraham, to Abram at the time. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." This is God's promise to Abram. And can we pause for a moment and remember that this promise was given to an old, childless man with a barren wife? God making these audacious promises about what was to come. This is God's promise. A promise that, if you notice, includes both benefits and responsibilities. The benefits being, you know, you will become great, a great nation, a great name, you receive great blessing. But then also the privilege or responsibility, you will become a blessing. You'll be a conduit of my blessing to all peoples on all the earth. And obviously today, as Christians, we believe this was ultimately fulfilled in Jesus, the one who brings salvation beyond all of these borders and categories to all peoples all across the earth. So this is God's original promise to Abraham. But then God went beyond the promise, and God made an oath to Abraham as well. We read in Hebrews where it talked about swearing by something greater. This is a concept we still understand today. If you've ever been in a courtroom or watched enough courtroom dramas on television, you know that there's a point when somebody takes the witness stand and somebody says, now it's not like they take the witness stand and they go, "So, you gonna tell the truth?" Yeah, that's not how it goes. Typically, they are asked, "Do you promise, do you swear to tell the whole truth?" And while they're doing it, they typically take their hand and they place it on a sacred book, typically the Bible. Why are they doing that in that moment? Because they are saying, it's more than just my word. It's more than me just saying, yeah, I'm going to be truthful. It's me saying, there's something greater than myself that I am placing my truthfulness on in this moment. We even have it colloquially when we say something like, or you hear someone say, I swear on my mother's life. You know, something like that. We make oaths on things that are beyond us, that are greater than us. And we see this happen in Genesis 15. God has already made a promise, and then God makes an oath, or we might call it a covenant. And yeah, it's a weird story. The story of God making his covenant oath with Abraham. I've preached on it in the past, and you can read about it this week. It's a strange story. A bunch of animals get cut in half, and then you sort of make a pathway with half the animal on this side and half the animal on that side. And then Abraham falls asleep into a deep sleep. There's this thick darkness that covers the whole scene. And then eventually there is a fire pot and a blazing torch that somehow move without assistance in between the pieces of dead animals. Not something we're familiar with at all. At least not to my knowledge. If some of you are doing that in your backyard, I don't want to come over to your house, ever. But as I mentioned in the past sermon, it's foreign to us, but in the ancient mindset, this would have been immediately understood for what it was. This is how two parties, two people, would cut a covenant, would make a covenant with one another. They would cut these animals in half, put them on either side, and then they would walk through those pieces of the animals as if to say to each other, if I break this oath, this covenant, may I become like these animals. May I become torn apart. That's how serious this oath is. I'm willing to be torn apart. So God made a promise, and then God made an oath. And these are those two unchangeable things we read about in Hebrews chapter 6. Although I would argue there's actually a third unchangeable thing that is sort of right there along with the other two that maybe is not quite as clear. But I think the third unchangeable thing is God himself. God gives a promise. God makes an oath. But it's all based on God's own self, God's own character. Because there is nothing greater to swear by. God swore upon himself. And if you remember the story in Genesis chapter 15, when it comes time to walk between the animals to make that covenant, it's only God, represented by the fire pot and the torch, only God walks through that, not even asking Abraham to do so. God takes everything upon himself, saying, I will make certain that this covenant holds together, even if I'm the one who becomes torn apart. And of course, as Christians, we believe today that this was, again, fulfilled in Jesus, the one willing to be torn apart on a cross in order that we might have that relationship with God. God's promise of blessing, God's covenant faithfulness, they're all grounded in God's self. I might call this like a trinity of unchangingness. God's promise, God's faithfulness, God's own character. And that, my friends, that is what our hope is based on. These unchanging things. God's promise, God's oath, God's own character. And I, for one, I don't know about you, I am so thankful that my hope is not based on my own promises or my own oath or my own character, because those things compared to those of God are so much less. I'm thankful that my hope is in something unchangeable. Even just think about the story of Christmas in regards to all this. There are so many participants: Mary, Joseph, shepherds, magi. They are all what I would call faithful participants in this story. But it all begins with the promises of God and the faithfulness of God. And just like that story, we are invited to be participants in this grand drama that God is unfolding. We're invited in, but it all begins with God's promises, God's oath, God's faithfulness, and God's own character. So when we get to this part in Hebrews 6, talking about, you know, this hope, that's what we're talking about, these unchangeable things. That's where we can trust that our anchor is found. But I started to think this week, so how does an anchor actually function? And I thought I knew. I was wrong. I thought it's a heavy thing. That's what it is. It's a heavy thing that stops other things that are less heavy from going places. And I found out, I looked on one page of one website about how to anchor things, and it blew my mind. It is way more complicated than I ever knew. Now, admittedly, I am not a mariner of any sort. My experience on boats is mostly limited to paddle boats, those I have done, pontoon boats, I greatly enjoy those. Those are great. I've been on a speedish boat one time. I got invited to a couple summers to go tubing. That was a lot of fun. My favorite form of water transportation, however, has got to be the lazy river that just sort of goes around the amusement park, and you just kind of float on that thing all day long. That's my favorite form of water transportation. So, like, I have never been, I don't think anyway, on, like, a big boat or in a big, huge body of water that I can remember. So it should not shock you that I looked things up about anchors and learned a lot because I didn't know anything. But the sheer different types of anchors, the way that you fix them to the bottom of the seabed and all that kind of stuff, it just kind of blew my mind. One of the things that I want to share with you that I think speaks to the idea that we're talking about today, about an anchor for our hope, was that when you're setting an anchor, I read that most boaters only do it half-heartedly. But that instead, to be sure that the anchor is set, you have to put reasonable strain on it for a reasonable length of time. That there's really no way to ensure that your anchor will hold unless you're pulling on it rather hard. And I read that and I thought this week, God, I do not like that actually. I don't like the idea of the strain and the pull. But what I think we learn is during those times in life, we're reminded that our anchor is set. That our anchor can truly hold. That there is a firmness and a security that comes from that. That we can be safe in the storms and we can be kept away from those rocky coastlines that might otherwise batter us or even destroy us. So, the anchor of our hope, four things this morning. Here's the first one. The anchor of our hope is unseen. The passage in Hebrews talks about it's in the inner sanctuary behind the curtain. Now, we have a sanctuary. We don't have an inner sanctuary that I'm aware of. If there is, I need to find out. I've been here a while, so there's an inner sanctuary. Somebody tell me. But I don't think we do. We don't have this curtain that's talked about. And it's because the author of Hebrews uses a ton of Old Testament imagery in this letter, and this is no different. The reference to the inner sanctuary behind the curtain would have taken the Jewish audience that received this letter immediately in their Hebrew context to the idea of the temple and specifically to the Day of Atonement. Because that inner sanctuary, whether the tabernacle or the temple, that inner sanctuary was the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. And it was a place that was unseen by any human eyes, save for one set of human eyes on one single day of the year. And on that one day of the year, the high priest of the people would go into that most holy place. And tradition tells us that they would wrap a rope around his ankle because that way, if he wasn't quite as pure in heart as maybe he needed to be, and the power of God overcame him to the point of death, ain't nobody going in to get him. They're just going to pull him out of that most holy place. But that one person would enter in on that one day, and that would be the only person to set eyes on that place where their hope was found. So as a faithful follower of Yahweh, you were invited to put a deep amount of trust in something you would never get to see. And frankly, I think that it's a lot easier to put your hope in things that you are able to see. Things that you can evaluate. Things that you can, you know, maybe even influence or control just a little bit, especially when life gets shaky. And honestly, if we start to lose confidence in something we've placed our hope in and it's something that we can see, then we can just sort of recast the anchor and find some other thing that we can see that might seem to be a little more attractive as far as firmness and security is concerned. It's easier to place our hope in things we can see. But we are invited in this passage to find our hope anchored in something that is beyond our ability to see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch. But it's a place that we can trust because that anchor is rooted in God's presence and God's power. Behind that curtain, That most holy place was where the presence of God dwelt in the highest concentration, where God's power was most manifested. It was the place where the Jewish people believed that heaven and earth would meet, where the God of heaven would meet with the people of the earth. It was the place where God's power and presence were. It was the place that was the most other of any place on the earth, the place that was the most other. And I think of that place and what we find there, the power and the presence of God. It reminds me when I was reading about anchors this week and about being anchored deep into the seabed, being anchored into something that is absolutely firm and something that's absolutely secure. So even though our hope, our anchor is unseen, we can trust where that anchor is rooted because it's God's presence and it's God's power. We also learn that the anchor of our hope is carried by Jesus. We read that he is the one who goes before us, that he enters in to that inner sanctuary behind the curtain on our behalf. The anchor of our hope enters that most holy place because Jesus enters that most holy place. So as literally as possible, in a figurative way, Jesus is the one who carries your hope. Jesus carries our hope. And in this passage, he is called the forerunner. Jesus is the forerunner, the one who goes before us. And that the Greek word for forerunner is a very rich term that can be applied to a lot of different things. And I looked at a few of them to sort of see the depth of what's being communicated here, that Jesus is our forerunner, the one carrying our hope. It can be used to refer to a military vanguard, which I read this week, the vanguard, also called the advanced guard, is that leading part of an advancing military formation. It has a number of functions, including seeking out the enemy and securing ground in advance. Jesus is the one who has gone before us, who has taken on the enemies of sin and death and shame and guilt. He's our forerunner. It also is a word that ties to the idea of first fruits. You know, that every harvest season, whether it's your harvest field or just your backyard garden, there's those first fruits, those first crops that come in. And in the Jewish culture, they would take those first fruits and they would offer them, and it was a celebration of God's faithfulness to them. So the vanguard, the first fruits, it was also a word you could apply to the person who crosses first place in some sort of race. My wife and I watched a movie recently about running a marathon, and it was funny. I love the quote. You know, somebody said, you're gonna run a marathon? You'll never win. And the response, of course, was, and this is exactly the truth, you don't run a marathon to win, you run it to finish. And what I love about this picture of Jesus as our forerunner is that he is the one who has crossed that finish line. But here's what I love about all three of these images, whether it's the military vanguard or the first fruits or crossing the finish line first and breaking the tape, all of those images suggest that there is always more to come. That Jesus, as our forerunner, is bringing more. He may be the first to enter, but he's bringing more. Jesus, his desire is to draw all of us into the power and the presence of God as our forerunner. And of course, we know in the gospel accounts that at his crucifixion, that curtain that was torn in two, and it fell to the ground, that this presence of God is now wide open to any that wants to follow after Jesus as our forerunner. So the anchor of our hope, unseen, the anchor of our hope is in God's presence and power, and it's carried by Jesus. And then finally, today, the anchor of our hope is tended to in the ongoing work of Jesus. He's referred to at the end of that passage we read as the high priest. The Jewish people had a long tradition, generations of high priests, those men who would go into that most holy place, generation after generation, in order to carry the hope of an entire community of people, to go to that inner sanctuary beyond the curtain as a way of maintaining that connection between God and his people. And so now we know and we trust that Jesus is the one who tends to our hope, firmly fixed in the presence and the power of God, maintaining that relationship and drawing us, drawing his people closer and closer to the power and the presence of God, to the point that just one chapter later in Hebrews chapter 7, we read this, because Jesus lives forever. He has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. Yes, Jesus was born a baby, but Jesus is the high priest who lives forever and continues to make intercession for the people of God. And I love that phrase, to save completely, because I don't know about you, I don't need just saved a little bit or like, you know, parts of me, I need it all. I need it all to be saved. I need all of it to be drawn in to the power and the presence of God. And because Jesus is that high priest who lives forever, he's the one who draws us into God's presence and power. So, a few things to think about as we finish our time with Scripture today to reflect on and to pray about. The first one is this. In what or who is your hope truly anchored? When life gets stormy, who or what gives you confidence to feel firm and secure? I really want you to think about this one, because I did as I was typing it out, thinking there are some temporal things that we put our hope in to feel firm and secure. You know, sometimes it's our family or thinking at the end of the day, I get to go home, or I have enough saved in my bank account, I know I'm okay. And it's okay to have some hope in some of those temporal things, but really, where is your deepest hope? If all of those things evaporated tomorrow, where would your deepest hope be rooted? Secondly, just take a moment today to thank God for his promises, for his covenant, for his unchanging divine character. Or third, where is Jesus, our forerunner, leading you in the power of God? Because I think collectively we're drawn into the power and the presence of God, but I also think that our forerunner is showing us individually where he may be leading us in the power of God. And then lastly, take a moment of silence and reflection to pray for someone you know whose life has been threatened by the wind and the waves, the storms of life, that he or she would know and trust that Jesus is the one who carries the anchor of our hope. So take a moment to reflect. I'm going to cycle through those questions one last time and still my voice so the Spirit can speak to each of us. And then I will close that time of reflection with a word of prayer in just a moment.